everyone. Thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's February 2023, and this is episode 326, which is a conversation about the pro-life movement after Roe v. Wade was overturned last year in 2022. On this episode, I'm joined by Jay Watts, who is the founder and president of Merely Human Ministries, Inc., an organization founded to equip Christians and pro-life advocates to defend the intrinsic dignity of all human life. Jay has written an online exclusive feature article for the Christian Research Journal. His article is called Life After Roe, a Follow-Up. And our subscribers can read his article for free at our website, equip.org. If you'd like to read his article and all of our other online exclusives, please subscribe to our journal at equip.org. Jay, it's good to have you on again.
It is great to be back.
One thing that the Christian Research Journal does focus on is Christian ethics. And so that includes the issue of abortion. Now, some people would say, well, I thought you don't cover politics, and we don't cover politics, but it just so happens that this particular issue has been politicized over the years, you know, more, I think, prominently since Roe v. Wade in the 1970s. But I just wanted to give that, you know, helpful kind of description or explanation to our listeners so they don't wonder, well, why are you guys always talking about abortion? But this is having to do with the value of human life, which the Bible talks about, and also just what it means to have a Christian ethic around valuing human life. So that's why we continue to focus on this. So I want to ask Jay, because he did write recently in our most recent print edition just about the aftermath of Roe v. Wade last June in 2022 when it was overturned. And then, of course, there's also the case Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health. And both sides have been very public in either their celebration about these decisions and a move towards an America without abortion for on the pro-life side, or you know, what abortion rights activists are calling abortion deserts. I think they would consider Texas one of those places where women struggle to find access to abortion and are forced to give birth to children they don't want. I mean, one thing Jay and I have talked about multiple times on this podcast is people sometimes focus less on the philosophical arguments than all these stories that women are telling. And especially after Roe v. Wade was overturned, you saw on social media people sharing their abortion story. A lot of celebrities came out, shared their abortion story, why this is so terrible. So just what has happened in the last, I guess, 7 months? Has the rhetoric calmed down on both sides regarding this issue?
So it had to, right? The rhetoric, the heat on everything, it had to come down. It was nowhere else to go, right? It reached a fever pitch at the decision time when Roe v. Wade was overturned and Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health became the new law of the land, or the new legal understanding of how we're going to approach it. Everyone went nuts. I mean, obviously pro-life side celebrated, and I know people that have spent their entire adult life fighting against Roe v. Wade. So that was a very big deal for them. There was some interesting conversations being had, whether it was appropriate to celebrate at the level that they were, but these were people who had spent an inordinate amount of resources, both human and financial, to reach a goal, and they reached it. And they were celebrating wildly with a belief that we were on the verge of seeing America making a turn towards valuing life and abortion going away. The other side sort of went to a hyperbolic outrage place. We had Jane's Revenge threatening a sustained attack on abortion, on pro-life facilities, and some of them actually following through. We had people talking about abortion deserts, as you mentioned in the question, these pockets of the United States that would exist like deserts where there was no access to abortion in them, and that women who wanted to get abortions would have to traverse these barren wastelands to get to a place where they could get abortion access or be forced to have children that they don't want to have. There was talks of secession, of a new civil war. We could not live together. So there was the place that we went to was so, the rhetoric came so hot and so heavy that we had to come down. And I think what forces you to come down is recognizing you have hard work to do. There is one thing to motivate your base, and that usually takes a very passionate, uncompromising message that motivates your base. But when you get to the point that I have to now convince the rest of the world, because you have the people on one side that are motivated and the people on the other side, and then you have everyone in the middle who, for them, this is just not an issue they live and die with like those other people. And so you have to motivate them now to do something on your behalf, to go out and vote or to get involved politically or to make decisions in their community. That's what Roe v. Wade was stopping. And now it's Dobbs versus Jackson means there's hard work to do in the states. So I think that they had to come down. I think that the place where we were made it only possible to go one direction, a more reasonable, hopefully, discussion and an engagement stage. So we're now deeply in engagement stage. There, some of the talking back and forth, you don't hear the Civil War talk anymore. Jane's revenge has disappeared for the most part, although they're being prosecuted now and they're being punished for the things that are the people. Some of them are being punished for the things they did. What we see now is a focus on the states so that we can look to pass laws, get involved in state constitutions. Everybody's trying to get to the work of winning on a local level, as opposed to making grand statements on a federal or larger level.
I asked you a few moments ago about abortion deserts. Can you kind of explain what those are? And then why the pro-choice movement would call them abortion deserts?
Well, yeah, if you think in a sense of a metaphorical desert, right? I grew up, deserts were a bigger deal on movie, like cartoons and things like that, than I think they are now. But there were these places where you had no access to anything that you needed. And when you have huge, particularly when you talk about the states, if you look at a map, and you can go to like Guttmacher Institute, which is the research arm for Planned Parenthood, where they keep very good detail, a record of what's going on around the country as far as laws, you'll see that the chunks of states that have dramatically restricted abortion access all sort of coalesce together. And so a woman who wants to get an abortion, who lives within these abortion deserts, has to go far away, which is why you see some of the businesses that are in perhaps like Florida and Texas and Georgia who are saying, oh, if our women want to get abortions, we will pay for their travel. One of the messages from the pro-choice side that I think that they've done very, very good job at messaging is that abortion restriction and these abortion deserts affect the poor more than anybody else. And so if they try to frame it as a justice issue for the poor, they say, look, a rich person obviously can take off from work and go do whatever they want and have the resources to travel anywhere that they want. But the poor person who's going to be most impacted by an unplanned pregnancy doesn't have the resources. And so we create this massive amount of area that must be traversed to get to a place where they can get the reproductive services that they're looking for through the practice of abortion. And that's just sort of, for them, it's a metaphorical wasteland. It is an area where there just is nothing for you to be able to access that will help you. And you have to get out of these deserts and go to the places that are more progressive and free thinking and forward thinking that'll give you the services that you need. Now, for the pro-lifer, we obviously look at that and we think, yay, look at all those sections of the United States that just aren't allowing abortion anymore. That's headway. That's great.
I think it's interesting. Both of us live in the Southeast, and actually I was driving back from Georgia and I saw right before I went into the state of North Carolina that it says, North Carolina, you know, come over to North Carolina. Abortion is legal here. So do you think there's a current side that's winning the legal battle, or is there a side winning the maybe marketing battle, or are both of them kind of equal right now? There sure has been a lot of press in major newspapers like the New York Times, just continually just the drumbeat of what's happening and, you know, how really they need to galvanize the pro-choice movement.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's so much going on right now, which is what you expected. When Roe v. Wade goes away, everybody now has to fight on a state level. That's the point of Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health. And so you knew there was going to be a flurry of activity. Everyone was prepared. Everybody knew this was coming. And so now they're having to enact the plans that they had. So I would say, here's how I would to honestly evaluate it. I would say, if you look at it, if we start at the moment Roe v. Wade is gone, and the whole country now is open, as an open battlefield for abortion law. And you have trigger laws all over the United States and states like Alabama and Mississippi, North Dakota, South Dakota, Georgia, places where as soon as Roe v. Wade is gone, laws are immediately enacted. And all of these laws immediately restricting access to abortion, not all of them. There are some of them, New York and Hawaii and other places that had trigger laws that would protect abortion rights. But if you look at the status quo, that's a massive move towards abortion restriction. That's a massive move immediately on that day or in the days immediately following towards a culture that's more affirming of a right to life. I think I mentioned Guttmacher a moment ago. Guttmacher's statistics said that they predicted that 26 states would very soon have an all but complete ban on abortion. They've now revised that down to 24 because South Carolina and Michigan were in play for the total ban, and they now do not appear to be because of different reasons. One, a constitutional amendment that was passed in Michigan protecting life, and in South Carolina, there was a stay on their trigger law based on some legal battles that are going on there. But in both of those cases, you still have 24 states that are now restricting abortion legally. They now have the legal right to restrict abortion, which they didn't have prior to Roe v. Wade. So immediately the field shifts towards the pro-life side. But since then, there's been a lot of little victories piling up for the abortion advocates. You expected them to get California, you expected them to get Vermont. There were states that they were going after with state constitutions that you expected them to win in. Michigan was one that nobody knew exactly what was going to happen. There was a hint that they would go, there's a thing called Proposition 3 in Michigan that enshrined abortion as a state constitutional right. And it was believed that was going to be closer than it was. And I know people that were fighting, obviously, for the pro-life side in that state, door to door, doing everything that they could to canvass the state to convince people. They got 55% of the vote to enshrine constitutional protections at the state level for abortion. And so as you see things like failure in Michigan, you saw Kentucky fail to advance a constitutional amendment protecting the unborn. You start to see victories for the pro-choice side in places that you didn't expect to see. Then Utah had trigger laws, and those trigger laws were blocked because the pro-choice lawyers and the people advocating for abortion rights were able to access the constitutional language that was originally meant to protect polygamy, where it said that every citizen of Utah has the right to form their family in the way that they see fit. And they were able to co-opt that language to protect abortion rights, saying that this is a part of that right that's in Utah. And the judge that saw that case agreed with it. So you see maybe temporary victories, maybe short-term victories, maybe longer-term victories when you're talking about something like Michigan, where it was an actual changing of the state constitution for the other side. And so right now, it feels like there is momentum for the pro-choice side, to say nothing of the red wave, right? I mean, so there feels like there's momentum for the other side, that they are winning battles that they did not expect to win, and that maybe they're being a little more clever about realizing very early that as a state-to-state battle, they can't win abortion with the same language in every state. In one state, they might, and I think South Carolina, it was privacy. I think it was an issue of privacy. In Utah, it was an issue of forming your own family, right? They're going to different states, and they're finding the language in those constitutions to be able to turn around and say, we already protect this. So now we want to include that in those places. Rather than one argument, which is what Roe had for every state, now every state is being fought over different reasoning. And I do feel like the abortion advocates right now, the abortion rights advocates, have done a good job at figuring out the weak spots to pick at and to go at and to amass some level of victory. They're winning on this issue right now.
It's a great time to subscribe to the Christian Research Journal, which you can do over at equip.org for $33.50. And we'd love it if you would do so, because it helps us to continue to bring you these weekly Postmodern Realities podcasts that you do get to enjoy for free. And also for all the online content that we're offering you, which is exclusive and separate from the print journal. And the last time we had a rating or review on Apple Podcasts was back in September. That was quite some time ago. Please think about helping us out just with the gift of your time to write a brief sentence about what you love about listening to this podcast, because it helps us with the algorithm, helps other people to find it. We'd be really grateful. I'd love to see some reviews that are dated for 2023. So thank you for partnering with us. Well, you just briefly mentioned the red wave, and I want to talk to you about that. And I also want to say to our listeners that in talking about the context of how this plays out in the United States in terms of this ethical issue, it is happening politically that I mentioned earlier. And also just as a matter of course, basically right now, there's just two major parties that have influence or win for the most part. And it's just that the platform for the Democratic Party includes language that is pro-abortion. And so that's kind of where that particular party on this issue falls. So when we talk about different parties, it's not that we're endorsing any party. We're just saying these are the parties right now that are either trying to advance some pro-life legislation or laws. And this is a party that is trying to, you know, enshrine or, you know, maybe take back what they're calling abortion deserts, like I mentioned at the beginning in the state of Texas. So just, you were talking about the red wave back, you know, there's some midterm elections in November 2022. There were supposed to be these big gains for the pro-life movement politically. It didn't seem to happen. So prior to the election, there was just a lot in the media just talking about how the vote needed to get out so that abortion rights could, even with Roe being overturned, that there could be some progress to retain abortion rights. So they were saying that people were really angered over what happened, and there was a lot in the media. Did you see that that was true as to why maybe there wasn't a bigger, quote unquote, red wave?
Yeah, to go back to what you said earlier, I think there's a couple of important points of distinction that I would like to make in the terms that I use, right? Because for me as an individual, my main thrust is love your neighbor as yourself. That's the entire motivation that I have. And then the big question then becomes, just like was asked of Jesus when he said that, who's my neighbor? And so I have a responsibility or obligation to find out how expansive my neighborhood should be. And I include the unborn in my neighborhood. And I think that they meet all requirements to be considered full members of the human family. When I talk about abortion rights advocates, I don't see that synonymous with the Democratic Party. Although, so when I talk about the activists versus Democratic Party, those are two different parties. Just like when I talk about pro-life activists versus the Republicans, those are two different entities that I'm talking about, although in a Venn diagram, they overlap somewhat. When you're talking about for the Democrats, though, there's in their platform, in their national platform, they have no room for anybody that is not fully supportive of a woman's right to abortion. That's why you see people like Charles Camosi at Fordham University, who has long been a pro-life advocate and an advocate for certain Democratic positions, who has struggled in the past couple of years for his place with the Democratic Party, because he says, I like so much of what they're doing, but I can't back them when they say you're not welcome if you feel this way about abortion. Now, the Democrats in this election, when they played on the idea that they believed that there was a lot of anger about what happened at the Supreme Court. And so they doubled down on abortion in this last election, believing that that would blunt the force of the red wave. There was a lot of things that made people think there was a red wave coming, like the Republicans were going to take a bunch of seats. Inflation was bad. Gas prices were bad. It was just an overall dissatisfaction with the functioning of the government. And so for the Democratic Party, they actually played, okay, let them talk about those things. We're going to talk about abortion. And specifically, when you read their strategist, they said, we're going to talk about it under the frame of reference that the Republicans want to outlaw abortion everywhere with no exceptions. And that's ultimately what they want. That's the game they're playing. So at a time where there may have been unease in the person who has no interest in this on a day-to-day basis about what they were seeing going on, the Democratic Party doubled down on this idea that not only are they going to take those rights at this point, but they're going to take them all the way. And part of their strategy was, they said, do not talk about states that have restricted access to abortion with gestational limits, like let's say 15 weeks, like Mississippi, like the law they were fighting over, or 6 weeks in Georgia, or 12 weeks in other states. They said, don't talk about gestational limits. One political pundit even using this phrasing, the general public is terrible at math. And so we can't give them anything to think about. We have to give them a broad argument, something that's blunt force, something that doesn't require any nuance or for them to sort through anything. It has to be all that the Republican Party is out to steal all rights to abortion under every circumstance. And they had a lot. They claim that that was a winner for them. It's very hard after an election to understand why it went the way it did. We didn't see a red wave. The Democrats controlled the Senate. Republicans controlled the House. You didn't see this massive outlet. There was other factors that may have been at play that they're maybe not worth going into at the moment. Some of it having to do with Donald Trump. But it's difficult when you look at an election to pinpoint what happened. What we do know is that the Democrats claim that they were successful in framing the argument about abortion in that way, that they were able to get a lot of mileage out of painting Republicans as a whole as being people who wanted to take rights away and sort of this religious fervor to make the world what they want it to be. So is it true? I mean, who knows? But they believe it happened. And we do know that a red wave that was supposedly guaranteed to happen because of things like inflation and gas prices and dissatisfaction with the general plan, it didn't happen. It didn't materialize.
So how would you say that pro-life people should respond to this, what happened? And or how is the movement responding to these, what seems to appears to be victories for abortion rights in the U.S.? And I think, as I said, there has been a drumbeat in the media to say, hey, we are winning. We are getting out there. Our message is getting out because, you know, this didn't happen with the election. And so do you feel like the abortion rights movement is kind of winning the PR war, maybe?
Yeah, I think now it's difficult when we talk about this issue to see where the general public is. They have a tendency to react and to sway. When you talk about what the majority of America believes, you have a percentage of people that are fully convinced and committed to one view, a percentage of people that are fully convinced to the opposite view. And then you have a smaller percentage in the middle of them that they manage the swaying back and forth of the political, of why we go towards the Democrats for a while, back to the Republicans for a while, very pro-choice for a little while, very pro-life for a while. They go back and forth. And so it's difficult to understand how they're feeling at any given moment. It may be that what looks like Democratic gains that could be encouraging to them over the long term could be just a reaction to Roe v. Wade being taken away. It may have felt like too much to them, and now they're looking for a balance to correct it. That is something that seems to happen a lot politically. As far as how the pro-life side should be responding to this, and let's differentiate here just the general pro-life movement versus individuals, a Christian, I think, is you see them realizing that they did not have the public support that they thought they had. One of the things I heard a Democratic pundit talking about recently was it's very difficult to get people oftentimes in the progressive side to come vote. It's easier to get Republicans. They believe it's easier to get Republicans to vote on these kind of issues. For the first time ever, they seem to be having success getting votes on this issue from their side. Their base is motivated, or the people that support their view are motivated. And so the people that I've talked to that run these campaigns, that were involved on the ground in these campaigns, what they have done is take the hurt. I mean, I've talked to some of them as these things are going down. It hurts. This is not a political battle absence of any investment of prayer and hope. The people who were fighting for their states believed that they were trying to bring into a reality, a state and a home that was more conducive to love life and to cherish it. And they lost in places they didn't expect to lose. And for some of them, they say it was the hardest thing they ever endured to have to make that case every day. Every human life ought to be treated with dignity and respect. We can't become a state that says it's okay to kill these human beings before they're born. And then they lost. And so they're taking that hurt. They're absorbing it, and they're taking a moment to understand what happened, but they're not deterred. And I think Scott Klusendorf, my former boss, my mentor forever, and a dear friend, said to me a long time ago, and it's a consistent message with him, make the main thing the main thing. So I think what we have to do is keep the focus on the one place they don't want to talk about, which is that life. We are doing something to that life, that unborn human, that fetal human, that embryonic human. Why do we have the right to do it? What is it? For me, as I've mentioned before, my whole life is about love our neighbors, ourselves, and figuring out who belongs in that category of our neighbor. And I believe in my heart of hearts, we are always at our best when we as Christians are seeing a more expansive view of our neighborhood. We include people in it, and the unborn ought to be included in it. And so for Scott, he would say, keep the main thing the main thing. Let's get it back on what we're talking about. And what we're talking about is, what is the unborn and what are our obligations and duties to them? Why would we say it's okay? So I think as we rally, and I mean that by people who are trying to create a culture that is more respective life from beginning to end, I think as they see what's going on and they're going to make their adjustments and they're going to keep arguing to try to convince people when, whether they lose on the law, they win on the person is what they're going to try to do. And I think that's probably the best move right now. They'll figure it out. Right. When I look at all this and I hear many of my friends celebrating the fall of Roe, I never really got as excited about it as they did. I was glad because it was a necessary step, but I never got crazy excited about it the way some of my friends did. And now when I hear people in the New York Times or in podcasts from the side of abortion advocates talking about these great victories they're having, I think they need to mute their responses as well. I think what we're seeing for the last 7 months is that we're in for a really long fight. It's going to take a while to sort this out. And it's not going to be a clear victory anywhere. Everywhere is going to be eventually, to some degree or another, compromise from what the purists on either side would like to happen.
So now the right to privacy no longer protects abortion across the United States. Now, how has the other side reacted in their particular rhetoric? And have they changed the way they're arguing about abortion in this new post-Roe reality? That's kind of interesting, because before there were certain ways that either side had argumentation before Roe was overturned. And so how has that changed since Roe has overturned?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think both sides have seen a change, or elements or people representing both sides have seen this as an opportunity to reset the rhetoric. It has long been known from people that read these things a lot and live in this area that the people who loved the result of Roe v. Wade weren't always in love with how they got that result. They didn't like it. There's an article that I think is a very interesting article written by a woman writing under the name of Charlotte Shane that was in Harper's Magazine, and she wrote it in October. But not just Charlotte Shane, but also Charles Komotsu, who I mentioned earlier, in a book that he's written about medical ethics called Losing Our Dignity. Both of those I've read recently, and then some other pieces in the New York Times as well. You hear or see people writing and expressing the other side was never happy with the way Roe v. Wade's argument was framed, because it wasn't about women and it wasn't about their right to control their own body. It was about that the unborn wasn't a human being in the same way the rest of us were. And because of that, doctors had the right to medical privacy with their patients to perform these actions without being punished for them. And so there was a sense, even going back, by the way, to Ruth Bader Ginsburg and her criticisms of Roe, there was a sense that Roe was written without women in mind, that it was mostly a championing of men or based on science. And so when Roe fell, now you see people pivoting to new arguments. And I think that the one written under the name of Charlotte Shane and Harper's is a great example of this new bodily autonomy argument. And you see it has been repeated in multiple different outlets. Think two other different editorials in the New York Times by two other authors that are saying similar things, where they say, look, there is a misunderstanding about pregnancy, that there is a life that's growing inside of the mother as if it existed separately, developed separately, and then was ejected at some point. And their argument is, there is no aspect of pregnancy that does not alter my body. I am altered in every way. They talk about pregnancy in terms of being an invasion. They talk about it as being dangerous, a hazard to women, a serious hazard, debilitating. They see pregnancy as this advance of a biology inside of them that's taking over their biological processes, oftentimes against a woman's will, or at least in so much as they like to talk about it. If they can get pregnant, they should have the absolute right to not be pregnant. Even saying that the people who have forwarded autonomy arguments before didn't go far enough in understanding, or at least expressing, how invasive every pregnancy was. I even read one person talking about the advancement of the the placenta into the uterine wall and how it pushes through with these spindles and attacks the blood cells, like the veins and the arteries. And so, it can suck its nourishment. And they talk about it like it's a monster consuming the inside of a woman. It's the worst case scenario is being brought up in every one of these. And for a reason, because they're trying to say that the biological burden on every woman who endures a pregnancy is so high and so unique in the human experience that no person should ever have to go through that if they don't want to. And they should have the absolute freedom if at any point during pregnancy, and these people aren't arguing viability or anything, they're saying at any point during pregnancy, if this person decides they no longer want to be pregnant, it is their absolute right to not be pregnant. And there are no other considerations that need to be brought up because nothing can balance against the costs that are paid by women through this process. And this is, as I said, it appears to be a corrective. The Charlotte Shane article in Harper's expresses that exact point. This is a corrective to a bad decision in Roe and bad language that's been argued before. We have to demand absolute autonomy and the freedom to not be pregnant anytime we want to not be pregnant.
One other thing the person who's writing as the pseudonym Charlotte Shane mentioned is that Christians are talking about abortion as a woman's issue, but when they do that, they're being hostile to the trans community because they're kind of trying to say, you know, Christians are defining women as a certain way, as this, you know, very binary way. And of course, we would say that women include people who are trans and that, you know, obviously being a woman is not necessarily only physical. It's deciding that you want to emotionally be a woman and so forth. And so this is a very limited way to talk about it. Why do you think that she's kind of doing that and saying this is how Christians are even narrowing it because they're saying, quote unquote, it's a woman's issue and they're not even saying that trans people are women?
Yeah, it's strange. Now, her exact wording as far as how she argues, puts her argument is that all impregnable people have the right, absolute right to not be pregnant. And she, as you said, she rejects the idea of this being. But then to turn around and say that it's conservative Christians who are trying to frame this argument as a traditionally feminine understanding of what pregnancy is and women being pregnant is a strange charge. I've been on the road for years, speaking at universities and schools for years, speaking at professional organizations. And I take Q&A, and I have heard in all of those years accusations against me when I speak about this issue. This is a women's issue. This is a women's issue. This is a women's issue. It has actually been my side that has argued, no, it's a moral issue. This is not a male or a female issue. It's a moral issue, and it ought to be argued on those grounds. And to try to dismiss any philosophical or scientific arguments that I'm making on the basis that I'm a man is just an ad hominem attack. You're not addressing anything that I'm saying. You're addressing me as a man and saying that I shouldn't be allowed to talk. And then for this article then to turn around and say, it's that side. It's people like me who want this to be binary in language, men and women get pregnant because I am attacking the trans community. Something that, by the way, I have almost never talked about over the years that I've done talked about the many things that I've talked about is an interesting attack. The only reason I can assume that you do it, and I see this a lot, and when you see this a lot in the modern tribalistic political battles that go on, is that there is a when you engage on one front, you want to rally your allies to your side. And if it's true, or if I can make people believe that it's true, that the attack on abortion is a part of a larger cultural attack on trans rights and LGBTQ rights and all of these things, then we have left, as I mentioned Scott earlier, keeping the main thing. Are we talking about the unborn anymore? And we're trying to engage in this large cultural war where all issues, and you have your tribe and I'm on my tribe. And so to say that the pro-lifer is necessarily some Christian who has also, in addition, these views that would exclude the trans community, exclude the LGBT community, gets it off of talking about the value of human life and gets it on to a greater cultural battle. And it brings in allies. I don't know if you saw it, and you may not have liked it, even if you did see it, but I thought the movie Spirited over the holidays with Will Ferrell and Ryan Reynolds, there was a song called We're Bringing Back Christmas, where selling Christmas trees, which has been in the frame of the movie as being lost and art that's being lost because people are buying fake trees more, the way to sell them was to cast the people that buy plastic trees into the tribe that you, they're the people that are trying to ruin Christmas and destroy America, right? And so, and that's what you see, I think, here, that you see this a lot on social media as well. Anytime you're trying to have a reasonable, focused discussion about a particular issue, one of the things that the person who doesn't do well in this issue will often do is try to cast what you're saying into a broader view of a cultural war movement so that you become the enemy. And that's the only reason I could think to try to, because I don't know a single, as a matter of fact, I know progressive atheists out there that are fighting the war against abortion almost, or maybe even more passionately than anybody else I know, who couldn't give a rip about any of these stuff, right? I mean, they're passionately also for the trans community. They're for the LGBT community. They have no problem with any of that. And it would be weird for them to find out that by saying women get pregnant, they're now in the camp of people who are trying to fight this broader cultural war against excluded and marginalized communities. So I think it takes it away from the main thing. And that's what I think the proper response is to get back to. I just don't have any interest in engaging in that at all. I want to talk about whether or not you have the right to destroy your offspring before they're born. That's the point that's interesting to me. And when you bring that stuff into it, it sounds to me like you're not confident in the reasonings you're giving. And I don't think that they have given good reasons. I don't think that the arguments that they've given rise to the level of being justification for destroying an innocent human life. If that's the case they're trying to make, right? The only reason that you make pregnancy sound so harrowing, it's the worst thing that could possibly happen, it is so difficult, is because you're trying to raise the level of danger and attack and assault and invasion that's represented by pregnancy to the level that it justifies destroying another human being. If you don't think the unborn are human, you don't need the justification. They're just not human. You don't need any justification at all. You can kill them. They have no value. But if they do have value, then you have to have justification. But if they are one of us, that's not justification for killing another human being.
I find it really fascinating in that article that you mentioned in Harper's. She says, quote, "It is critical to understand that the, quote, pro-life movement, end quote, is much more than an anti-abortion cause. It's a pro-pregnancy crusade for pushing pregnancies to be maintained at any cost," end quote. I think that's a really interesting way of putting it. It's like, well, it's more than that they're against abortion. They want to force women or people who can give birth, almost like in a dystopian sense, that yes, all of them have to be pregnant at any cost.
Yeah, we've heard this for years. It's a weird charge, right? I mean, I was speaking, I remember one time, and a group said, you're a forced birther, which I have no dog in that fight. I don't care if you decide you want to be, you get pregnant, to get pregnant or not get pregnant. So, and they would say, if you win the right to restrict abortion, you will then by extension have the right to force birth. So no, you have no idea what you're talking about, right? Because I think that human beings ought to be treated with dignity and respect, and that all human life ought to be protected. I'm not, and there's no way that I want or believe that I have the right to impose my will on other people. I just don't believe when we talk about human beings, that human beings should be allowed to kill each other. And you don't. Most people don't. Most people don't think human beings should just be able to kill each other for very little reason. That's just a shared community belief among us all. And we all believe that act ought to be restricted, and that there ought to be a way that we police that within our system, and that we find laws that make sense to stop people from killing each other. The difference in opinion is I think that the unborn fall in the category of those who shouldn't be killed, and you don't, for the most part. Not you, Melanie, but the person I'm talking to. So the idea that by extension, then I believe we have the right to force people to get pregnant is a strange leap for me. If you believe you have the right to do this, like China, right? China believes that they agree that there's a right to choose, but China disagrees about who gets to choose. China has for a long time, when they had the one child policy, believed that the nation and the community gets the right to choose. They agree on choice. So when they look at China, and I've had people say, look at China and look at how they interfere with people being able to have the families that they want to have. I said, yeah, look at China. They agree with you on the idea of choice. They just disagree with you about who has the choice. I disagree altogether that the choice is legitimate. those your views and their views then become a difference of degree, where mine's a different of kind. I have no interest in forcing people to get pregnant. I have no interest in forcing people to birth children. What I have an interest in is not living in a community where people believe that there's an entire class of human life that they're allowed to destroy for almost entirely trivial reasons.
So there have always been these claims that the goal of the pro-life movement is to control women and punish them for making their own decisions about abortion. And so I'm wondering, are there any elements of the pro-life movement that are moving in that direction now that Roe v. Wade has been overturned?
Yeah. Now, here's an interesting thing about answering that question is that the people who are pushing what we now call equal protection laws would not identify as pro-life. They would identify more often than not, they identify as abortion abolitionists. They believe in the 100% abolition of abortion right now. And that is the only position that you can argue for. That they would argue that someone like me, who argues for let's advance what we can advance, save who we can save, is that I am accepting abortion, which I am not. But they would argue that. And so they, because they reject people like me or the views that I hold, they reject identification with people like me and don't want to be categorized with someone like me. So if I would say, oh, sure, I accept the pro-life tag, I accept all sorts of tags when you're talking about the unborn life, they reject it because they don't want to be seen as in league with us. They accept a view that all human beings have value the same way that I do. All human beings ought to be treated with dignity and respect like I do. But they see abortion as murder, and that murder must be punished equally the same way in all cases. And so if we would punish any human being for murder, when they murder an older, more mature human being, we have to punish them for being involved or complicit in a murder when they murder someone who is yet to be born, a fetal human being. And they see this as the only way to be consistent with the idea that all human beings are fully human. And that if you believe that, then abortion's murder and that murder must be punished. And they're seeking equal protection. Even the state of Georgia, where I live, they're seeking equal protection. Now, they haven't advanced them very far in any of the places where they've had the bill introduced. So there hasn't been a place where they've gotten it far. But you see it popping up more. And I'll tell you what's interesting is, for the first time, I've been having conversations with people that for years and years I agreed with, that were so encouraged by the fall of Roe, that we were in this place that we were getting close to a society that embraced the unborn as fully human, that they have moved towards this abolitionist position. And people, these are people I've been friends with for a very long time that I'm having conversations with, where they just adamantly express that if a woman commits the crime of abortion, she has been active in the crime of murder, and that she needs to be punished. And that is the only, if we don't seek equal protection, and by seeking equal protection, what they mean is that you go into state constitutions and you remove any language from those constitutions that protects people who have harmed the unborn from being subject to murder and laws for killing human beings. That's how they want to do this, right? And so that has been a growing movement. I would like to say it was still more marginalized. It has been, I think, a more marginalized view in the anti-abortion umbrella for many years, but I don't think it's as marginalized as it once was. And I have heard voices supporting it now that I find surprising. I think it's the power of it, I think, is twofold. One is it's a simply understood message. If you believe abortion is murder, then you have to act like abortion is murder. And I think another thing, and Scott Klusendorf, I mentioned him several times today, but he and I had an exchange about this recently. He mentioned too, that it's very attractive to this sort of hyper-aggressive moment that we're in the cultural engagement, that it has the look about it of people who are willing to take on the bad guys head on and to not back down and to not be compromising. And that's an attractive quality about it as well. I think both of those are reasons why we've probably seen it grow in ways that I was surprised.
So you're talking about this new view, or maybe a view that was a little bit very niche before, and it's just coming up a little bit more, about equal protection in terms of treating all murder and punishing everyone involved, including the mother that you just mentioned. Do you think that's causing a division among Christians and pro-life advocates in the movement, or is it still, you know, fairly niche, or do you see it growing in popularity to have that view?
I think it has always divided to some degree. There has been year when I worked with Life Training Institute, I have had most of my life in the area where I work, a personal commitment to not argue with other people who are fighting against abortion. And every once in a while, Scott would come to me and he'd say, you have to engage these people. That's an order from the boss. And I would have to engage this view in writing or in discussion publicly for a short period of time, because he said, we have to be clear who we are and what we are. And sometimes that just requires us speaking up. And he knew that I didn't like it, but he also knew he felt that it was his responsibility to have voices heard. So it's always been divisive. It's and the pro-life movement, by the way, is divided. It's funny to me when you go to the March for Life, if you've ever gone to, which is a really cool thing in DC. I was joking one time. I would get at the very front of the march or close to it as I could. I would walk to the Supreme Court early. And then so I would walk back on the side and see the march coming from the other way, because it's very large, hundreds of thousands of people. And every time I did that, I would be afforded the opportunity to talk to people who disagreed with what we were marching for. And it was always interesting. And one of them said, I just never understood. I've never known that there's just this many people that feel passionate about us. The interesting thing about all these people is that 364 days of the year, they don't barely get along with each other. They're all disagreeing about how we should fight abortion. They all have different ways that they think we should approach it. They all think the other person is compromised or not doing the right thing or wasting their time. They all think they're right and other people are wrong. It's just today, they all are happy and get along with each other. But so there's always been division, and that particular niche group of people have always been a little bit more aggressive in their desire to be divided from us. I mean, I'm trying not to mix anything up here or to soft sell it. They think people like me, for the most part, or people that work in the area where I work, are very compromised individuals. They do not have a high opinion of us at all. And so their unwillingness to call themselves pro-life comes from a place of deep dislike for what they see us doing and how they see us approaching things. I do think it's grown, and that's troubling for me in the sense that I've had conversations with people that I like recently, and I still like, and I still respect them, where I can hear in their voice that they've lost respect for me as they have fallen into this view. So yeah, it is divisive. I don't think it's a big deal. I mean, because it's always been divided. I think that it can be used as a hammer to hit the whole movement for, but everybody's always going to do that anyway. They're always going to try to color the people that disagree with them with the worst possible color they possibly can. But I think it's as a divisionary force, it has grown a bit more. We'll see if it has legs. We'll see what happens over the next, because they're advancing a lot as far as in different states, but it's not going to get, we'll see if it gets anywhere, because that's always been the thing I've responded to them. It's like, I appreciate your passion. I appreciate your zeal. I appreciate your commitment to the value of human life. What you're doing doesn't seem to be working. So
just from talking to you in this podcast, it seems like there's just a lot of rhetoric flying all over the place, either from within the movement and people who are abortion rights advocates. It seems like everyone's just on this really kind of aggressive posture with their view. So how can just, you know, the Christian in the pew kind of thing, the average Christian who holds to a pro-life ethic, how do they find ways in engaging without getting caught up in some of the controversies or being overly discouraged by all of the articles out there being written by abortion rights activists? Because there's so many that are being published.
So many.
In some your way, you can start reading that and thinking, okay, what happened here is now the pro-life movement on the losing end, even though Roe has been overturned. So help the average Christian to navigate some of this.
I think the first thing, going back to what, and I've heard you mention this several times, and I talked about the idea, I've been asked recently to clarify my views on things and to understand who I am in the ministry world. And I always tell people the same thing: love your neighbor as yourself. I mean, it's one of the great commandments, right? All other commandments are known from love the Lord your God, love your neighbor as yourself. If the unborn are our neighbor, then we have a responsibility and duty as Christians, as part of the great commandments, to follow and honor God, to love the unborn as we love ourselves. And so as I look into the pew and I get back the question, why should I engage in a world that is filled with so much aggressive rhetoric? My answer would be because as Christians, whether you see yourself as a Republican or a Democrat, whether you see yourself as apolitical or deeply political, however you identify and all of those other things, as a Christian, we have a responsibility and a duty to love our neighbor as ourselves. And so we must engage the important moral issues of our age. As one, I saw a young man at a school where I was speaking said, I don't understand why any of this matters to me. This is all about politics. And I said, how do you think the world that you live in is shaped, young man? How do you think the laws that are passed? How do you think that your world is governed? How do you think anything gets done? Politics is not something that exists separate from you. You shouldn't live in a world of amusement and leave the world of politics to somebody else. Your advocacy, your responsibility and duty to be involved in politics. As a Christian, for me, I went through this young and I realized that I have a duty and responsibility to be a Christian voice in the political world, in the sense that when I speak, I have to make sure that someone is talking about those things, and not just me, but other Christians doing the same. We're all talking about those things that are important to us. So the first thing is, why should I care? Because the unborn are our neighbors, and we're told to love our neighbors as ourselves. The next question of how do I not let it turn me into a narcissistic monster? Because when you engage online, that's a lot of what you see out there is people that become obsessed with their impact, their voice, their influence, their platform. And they see any attack on those things as an attack on their views, which it simply is not. It's an attack on your platform or you. It can be very personal and not have to be about the bigger issues. And you can get sucked into a dangerous way of understanding the world. Well, I think one way to stop that from happening is to go back to what I just said again a moment ago. Is that my job is to love my neighbor as myself. And my neighborhood includes more than just the unborn. It includes those people who disagree with me. I was once an outspoken pro-choice guy, and somebody took the time to be gracious and as a representative of the mercy of God and to speak into my life in a way that helped me to turn the whole thing around. And now I live closer, hopefully, to Christ, more in accordance with his will, more like him, reflecting him more in the world around me. Making me a right thinker didn't just stop me from doing bad things. It welcomed me into a life that is much more abundant with joy than anything that I could have imagined before. And so there is more to be won than arguments. There are people to be won. And we can win them by demonstrating our love for our fellow man. Outside of abortion, I've talked about Charles Camosi in his book, Losing Our Dignity. And at the end, as he talks about neurodegenerative progressive disorders that people, the elderly, are facing and the impossibility with the numbers that we're looking at of finding caregivers, he says, I know this is optimistic, you know, idealistic in the way that I'm looking at it. But if we had a massive religious movement back to Christianity and then saw dealing with other human beings as part of our sacrificial service to our community as Christians to demonstrate the love of Christ to the world, man, we can change the world and we can reach people who just need to be loved and helped and have caregivers there for them so they can still have human community even as they face the worst parts of their life. That's aspirational, right? So when we say, what can Christians do? We have to remember to love our neighbors as ourselves, both the unborn, which requires us to get involved, and those who disagree with us, which requires us to not turn them into something that they shouldn't be seen as. They're not monsters. They're people who believe wrong things, dangerously wrong things, yes, but they can be turned towards Christ as well.
Well, thanks, Jake, for giving us a lot of food for thought on this issue as we continue to wrestle with it. You know, I think people thought, well, Roe v. Wade is overturned, so now everything's over. But it doesn't seem that way.
No, it's just getting started. Unfortunately, for people who hate this issue, it is just getting started.
Well, finally, I have something to end on a lighter note with Jay, and I've been asking authors to give a word that you want to describe 2023 for you. So what is one word you're hoping your life will encompass in 2023?
Huh.
It could be any word.
Productive. I would like to be productive. And I don't mean that just in a trivial sense, or I don't mean that as in a purely vocational sense. I would like to end this year and feel like I did what I could do that year. That I did what I could do. Maybe obviously we all fall short, but I would like the end of this year to be able to look back on 2023 and say, God, we got a lot done there. That was a good one. Right.
I think we'd all like to be productive. Well, thanks, Jay, for being a guest again on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to episode 326 of the Postmodern Realities podcast. Today's guest was Jay Watts. He's the founder and president of Merrily Human Ministries, Inc. Jay wrote an online exclusive feature article for the Christian Research Journal. His article is called Life After Roe, a Follow-Up. Our subscribers can read his article for free at our website, equip.org, when they log into their journal account. And if you would like to be able to read all of our online exclusives, please subscribe to our journal at equip.org. Stay connected with the Christian Research Institute and all the new content we have coming your way. The best way to do that is to head on over to our website, equip.org. There you will find thousands of free resources right at your fingertips, from articles to video to audio, and it's all for free. You'll find our podcasts hosted there, as well as the Bible Answer Man broadcast, which is hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff and streams live every Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern. In addition, you don't want to miss out on subscribing to Hank Unplugged, which is the podcast of Hank Hanegraaff. And in that podcast, he has really in-depth, free-flowing, essential Christian conversations with some of the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people. And in addition, he has a new series on his podcast feed called Hank Unplugged Shorts, which Hank goes into the headlines in the mainstream media and refutes a lot of those cultural issues that we have in these short podcast episodes. And there's quite a few of them. You don't want to miss out on them. Now, if you want to find some of this at other places where it's all in one place, really subscribe to our YouTube channel. It's a great way to get all of our content there, our podcasts there, and different individual questions theologically that people have that Hank answers at our YouTube channel. Now, you might be thinking to yourself, I don't know how to subscribe to YouTube. I don't have a YouTube account. Well, actually, you might just have a YouTube account. If you have a Gmail address, you have a YouTube account. Just log into YouTube with your Gmail address and search for Bible Answer Man channel, and please become one of our subscribers. In addition, if you see that bell icon right there on our front page, please click that, and every time that we have new content, you will receive a notification that new content is up on our channel for you to be able to consume. So thank you so much for the ways in which you partner with the Christian Research Institute. We are grateful for you listening and reading and watching.